Welcome to the PI Podcast, political insights for the palaging inis. I'm your host, Matt Ordonez. And as you can see, this month has been quite a rough month. We've been experiencing a lot of heavy monsoons, floodings, and earthquakes. And a lot of the times, you know, the Philippines has been a very resilient country. We've talked about that in the past. But of course, these changes, you know, climate change, environmental politics, has been a bit put on the side for a long time, despite us being one of the most affected countries by a lot of these changes around the world. Of course, the world is getting hotter, and now if it's not hot, it's extremely wet. You know, a lot of flooding's happening. You know, and how much of it can we solve politically? I mean, a lot of the times the weather is unpredictable, uncontrollable. But then there are, of course, some discussions that in a way put accountability to human actors, particularly, you know, governments, companies. And I want to start in this podcast on how we can create political solutions to these environmental problems. You know, it's been an issue for a long time, ever since, almost as old as modern day politics in the 20th century, from greenhouse gases to the Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore to, of course, Greta Thunberg, you know, the young environmental activist, to even activists now that are throwing soup in on paintings just to make a point. But are there better ways to find these environmental solutions? Because it has, while, you know, there have been a lot of issues discussed in social media, environmentalism tends to be around, but not as focused. So perhaps we can figure out how to have better conversations about this. And for this episode, I have a special guest with me. And of course, he was a former batchmate and classmate of mine in Ateneo. But he has done a lot in terms in the field of environmental advocacy. In his current affiliations, you know, he has written a lot of articles, op-eds, even a few TED Talks. You know, right now, he is the Deputy Executive Director for Programs and Campaigns at the Living Laudate Si Philippines. He is a member of the Interim Secretariat of Action Clima Filipinas and a member of the Youth Advisory Group on the Environmental and Climate Justice of the UNDP in Asia and the Pacific. Of course, this is just a sample of all of the affiliations he's had in the field of environmental activism. So please welcome John Leo Algo. John, thank you for stopping by to the PI podcast.
Yeah, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Whatever time you're listening to this podcast, I hope everyone listening out there is having a great day. And thank you as well, Matt, for inviting me to be your guest on this episode of your podcast.
Okay, of course. Let me just start off by saying, you know, it's been a long time since we've actually met each other on campus, you know, and again, I have been paying attention to what you've been doing in social media, and it's quite impressive. But I am curious, though, I'm not sure I've asked you in detail, you know, how did this journey into environmentalism, you know, begin? And can you tell us maybe how about your journey and why this particular field?
You know, I'd never really realized it until years later, but before my, what I could say would be my, in air quotes, origin story, even back in grade school or high school, I've always had inclinations about environmentalism. Like, I can remember back in grade school where a couple of classmates of mine, with myself, we would staple empty bags of chips on our shirts, and then we would do a performance in front of the school. And I remember back in high school, I had to choose an elective class. And for some reason, I chose environmental science. I didn't even know why at the time. So at some point, during those points, I just felt like I've always been gravitating towards this kind of field. But as I mentioned earlier, I consider my, in air quotes again, origin story to be September 26th. 2009. So that was towards the end of my very first semester in the Ateneo.
Right.
So, yeah,
I remember that.
I was taking my, well, that was my first semester as an environmental science undergraduate, and I was actually thinking about shifting out because at the time, I still had a dream of pursuing a law career. And then that was a Saturday, September 26th. I remember that day specifically because that morning I decided to go to a nearby internet cafe a couple of blocks from my relative's house. Actually, I was not even at home. I was vacationing for the weekend in a relative's place somewhere in the Marikina area. And then, as I mentioned, I went out that morning, went to an internet cafe, and played, believe it or not, I played Grand Theft Auto 4. By the way, for those,
Classic. Yeah.
yeah, for those of you watching, for those of you listening, rather, play responsibly. Whatever video.
Yeah.
That's, we don't want to promote violence here.
Okay,
And
definitely.
then a few hours after that, the store manager tapped me on the shoulder and he told me to leave. And I was wondering why. He pointed outside, and as it turns out, the street outside is already knee deep in floods. And that was the beginning of the next 8 to 10 hours of
Right.
me and a bunch of other stranded people being exposed to the elements. Strong winds, heavy rainfall, and of course, torrential flooding.
Yeah.
What I remember that day, especially some of the images I saw, those are things that no one should ever experience in their lifetime. And it still haunts me to this day, to be honest. Like during a heavy rainfall episode, especially in that particular area, because I still pass by there sometimes.
Yes.
Those memories come back in my head, and I kind of need to take a few deep breaths. Those things, they just don't go away that easily. Anyway, I was able to go back home after 10 hours, well, home being my relative's house, and the first floor was actually flooded. That has never happened before to them. And I turned on the television at the second floor of that particular house, and I saw this newscast on GMA7. And that's when I and probably millions of other people finally understood exactly what Tropical Storm Ongoy did to the capital, to the NCR, basically. 1 month's worth of rainfall unleashed in just a couple of hours. 6 hours, actually.
Yeah.
And that stuck with me to this day. And that is my origin story.
Yeah.
Safe to say, I did not shift out of my course.
Okay. Good idea. Yeah.
And inspired by that incident, I decided to become a climate advocate.
That's actually a very cinematic way to do it. I remember that also very well because aren't if you remember correctly, our entire batch, we're supposed to start in Ateneo, our first year, but it was pushed to a whole month. And of course, I think the first, well, if I remember correctly, my first moments in Ateneo was not going to class, but packing relief goods. And I
Yeah.
think that, yeah, I think you did that as well, right? Like most of us did. Packing relief goods for those affected by this area.
Yeah. And just to add to that, just for those who are listening to this podcast but are not familiar with the Ateneo culture, I suppose. During our first few weeks in the campus, at least before then, we had like an orientation seminar. We called it ORSEP. And as you mentioned, because of what was going on during the first few weeks, we didn't really have that, at least not the kind of ORSEM that other batches had. So we spent our time. Well, so I remember some of my blockmates were sick, and then some of us were, again, as you mentioned, we were packing relief goods to help out other people. But definitely, those first few weeks were almost like a foreshadowing
Right.
in a way of what's about to
It
happen.
yeah, it's kind of like a common canon event if you watched Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. It's like, yeah, it affected a lot of people differently, but so So after, okay, you didn't shift into your course. Maybe so. Can you tell us what, of course, what kept you in the course, and then what did you learn? Maybe up until the first moments after graduating Ateneo into being a professional in the field of environmental science.
Well, my origin story is what kept me in my course, definitely.
Yeah,
I realized that, you know, actually after high school, I wasn't exactly sure. I mean, I did have a thing about wanting to be a lawyer, but then I realized that after that incident that perhaps there's something else that we can dedicate our lives to, something to focus more on, where we can, there are different ways of helping people, especially the most vulnerable, the marginalized peoples. And learning more about the science of climate change, and of course other environmental issues as well, and the interlinkages between them, that really gave me a new profound insight on the many ways that we can really help address the numerous social, environmental, and economic issues that really affect our country. So that is basically what kept me going. And of course, it turns out I love my course. Just took a couple of months for me to really get it, actually a couple of years. But it really helps to also have a supportive faculty.
Yes.
And my blockmates as well.
Yeah.
I consider them as like a, almost like a family these days as well.
Okay. Sorry. I've just realized it's actually interesting. Your course is in environmental science, but where is it positioned in terms of the natural science and the social science? Is there maybe, is it in between or what? Because I just realized that there might be a lot of interest. I don't know. I myself, I'm not quite familiar. So maybe you can tell us, like, what is environmental science and where does it lie between the social science, like politics, economic sociology, and you have the natural science, which is like the, you know, chemistry, zoology, botany, and all the other things. I think I assume that it might be closer to like the natural science, but what do you think? Like, where does it lie?
I might sound a bit biased, but I'm just going to say this. I personally think, it's just my opinion, that environmental science, I think, is the most well-rounded, complete course in the Ateneo de Manila University.
Oh, wow.
That's just my opinion.
Okay.
That's just my opinion.
Yes.
I'm sure there are people out there who might say, what about the honors courses? Like, you know, they're more competitive and all that, but I don't care what you say.
Yes.
It's called environmental science for a reason. And
right.
You're right, exactly right about what you said. We have to deal with, technically, it's a natural science course because it's under the Science and Engineering School of Ateneo. But again, like you mentioned, we have to deal with not just biology, chemistry, physics, lots of math, some statistics, some psychology even. We also have to deal with sociology and anthropology. Of course, history. Love history classes.
Yes.
Political science, absolutely. That's definitely a must-have. And we also have to deal with, because it's the Athenian way, philosophy and theology classes. A couple of management courses as well. You have to deal with basically an interdisciplinary approach. Because when you talk about the environment, most of us associate the environment, for example, with nature. And of course, that's correct. But for me, if you also look at the most basic definition of environment, it's literally everything that surrounds us. So if you find yourself, for example, in a classroom setting, like literal classroom, there's nothing really natural there per se, but it's still an environment. But the one thing that's actually very common, that's the one presence that's around that classroom, is humanity. There's a touch of human, there's a human touch in how the chairs were made, how the whiteboards were made, how the projector was set up. And of course, the classroom itself, when it's being properly used, is full of people. So for me, when it comes to environmental science or environmental issues, nature is front and center, absolutely. But it can't just be about nature too. We also have to consider the link, the interlinkages. The touch of the human perspective matters just as much, in my opinion. So for me, that's how I can best describe environmental science.
All right. Thank you. Now, okay, let's move forward to like after you've graduated the Ateneo, you know, you are now in the field, you know, how do you, what do you think are your, maybe your contributions? Like, are, do you contribute as maybe like a natural scientist, or I am actually, well, I'm aware that you've done some advocacy work, which is a bit more in the social science, but maybe you can tell us a bit more on what kind of work that you do or what you have done. And is it more on the natural science research, or is it more on the social and political advocacy, like, or maybe a bit of both? What have you been doing?
You know, there were, before I answer that question, just to give a more context, there are three specific people in the Ateneo that their words really influenced my approach in my post-college career, well, post-college life. No, it's not just career. It can't just be about the career anymore, especially about after COVID, you know. Got to have a life, not just a career. But there are three particular people in the Ateneo I'd just like to specifically mention. So number one, attorney Antonio Lavinia, of course, Philippine environmental lawyer.
Love that guy.
He's pretty much a mentor to literally everyone he's ever met in one way or another. It's from him where I got the inspiration to pursue or to further study climate science.
Yes.
Which is weird because he's an environmental lawyer.
Yeah.
But I've become very interested in the climate negotiations when I attended his elective classes. In fact, I enjoyed his classes so much, I signed up for it twice.
Oh.
And, one under the political science department, one under the environmental science department. So there's kind of a loophole there.
Right.
But I enjoyed it anyway. But I still engage with him in my current work to this day, and he's still a mentor to pretty much all of us. And that's where he's actually the one who, from whom I got that impression that if you want to understand the climate crisis, if you want to understand environmental issues, before you can go into politics, law, advocacy work, economics, you got to understand the science first. Because at its very nature, climate crisis, plastic pollution, whatever environmental or climate issue you can think of, if you don't understand the problem, you can't think and develop the proper solutions. So you have to understand the science first. And climate and environmental issues have that inherent scientific nature to them. So that's what made me pursue my master's degree in atmospheric science, also in the Ateneo.
Okay.
And that leads me to the second person that I like to specifically mention, the late, great Dr. Gemma Narizman. She was also the leader of the Regional Climate Systems Research Group of the Manila Observatory. And it's through her where I really understood. And I remember what she said to me during the interview process before I got into the Manila Observatory at the time. This was back in 2014. And what she said was, the ultimate purpose of science is for the advancement and the betterment of the Filipino society. So science is not just for knowledge's sake, but you also have to apply it. You have, and not just apply, you know, to make money or to say, hey, I'm innovative or something like that.
Yes.
But you have to apply it and improve the lives of the people. Because ultimately, that's what science should be all about.
Right.
So after finishing my master's degree and after I left the Manila Observatory, because at the time, I was still training to be a climate scientist. And also air quality. So I spent, I think, 4 years in the Manila Observatory, also while taking my master's. So I was actually trained to be a climate scientist. But then through those 4 years, I also realized that perhaps that's not exactly going to be my main field, because sometimes, you know, figuratively speaking, the pieces of the puzzle just don't fit.
Okay.
So maybe there's a more specific aspect of climate work out there that's more suitable for my temperament, for my skill set. So after that, and this is where the third person comes in, Dr. Severino Salmo, former Ateneo faculty member, and perhaps the Philippines' leading expert in mangroves. So I was feeling a bit lost at the time that I spoke to him, because you know, again, things weren't exactly going well as well as I thought it would be. And he just, and I asked him for some advice, and he just told me to go where I needed.
Okay.
So not just to fill a particular position, but remember your origin story, to always remember why you're doing what you do. And once you remember your origin story, and I've shared my origin story already, then you'll know where you're needed. And So for the next couple of years, after my time in the Manila Observatory, I also decided to pursue my passion, which is writing.
Okay.
So, and since 2016, I've been a contributor to multiple international and local media platforms. So I've contributed op-eds, articles, even film reviews recently. I decided to write film reviews, and I'm just glad that some of my environmental articles got a lot of likes. Not all, just some, because it's really hard to popularize environmental journalism in this country. And I know there are full-time environmental journalists out there that deserve a lot of recognition. So to be able to just make my own contribution through those particular stories, and a few of them did kind of did influence a little bit the political discourse in terms of policy and climate and environment of Philippines, I'm just glad that I was able to make even that kind of contribution. And of course, if you want to talk about my current work, I started my full-time advocacy work. I'll cite as the starting point the Climate Reality Leadership Core Training in March of 2016. That's when former U.S. Vice President Al Gore came to the Philippines and conducted that training. And I believe there are more than 600 Filipino climate reality leaders or volunteers that were in Sofitel, in I think Pasay City. So literally everyone that I work with now, or at least the people that I started working with and the people that I work with now, they also know those people. Literally every single one of them I met through that training. And that training actually is a blessing for me, because I applied for other tra for two or three other trainings, but they were in other countries, so I couldn't go. So when the training really came here to Manila, I made sure that I would attend. And honestly, in terms of my current work, it's the starting point, and I'm really glad that I took the chance and attended the training.
Wonderful. Very so now that we've established like your professional career from your origin story to your professional career, I do want to ask you your expert opinion now. Like, what do you think are the currently the most pressing environmental issues affecting the Philippines? Like,
Well, for me, of course, my number one answer would be the climate crisis, because that's my main field of specialization. But to me, it's also a bit of a misnomer now to just say climate change as an environmental issue. Because to me and to many other people, it's no longer just an environmental issue. We consider it an all-encompassing global threat that, by definition, because it's the climate that's changing, it would literally affect everything and everyone in so many ways. So, yes, while that also has environmental aspects of it, we consider it not as just as no longer just an environmental issue. It's also a social issue, economic, political, cultural, even ethical. So, which brings me to my actual answers to your question. So, number one, I think the one of the most important issues is on just energy transition. And very recently, also from the public sector to the private sector, it's becoming a big issue, the just energy transition. And it's not just a transition, it's a just transition. What that means is that we have to make sure that, okay, it's well established by science, and even the countries at the negotiations that don't want fossil fuel phase out to happen, even they know deep down that it has to happen, because climate change is caused by burning fossil fuels, which emits greenhouse gases, therefore your global warming, and of course climate change. So how do you address that? You mitigate. You reduce the use of fossil fuels. Like, there's no question about that. But of course, we have to also recognize that our world, like the Philippines, is currently heavily dependent on fossil fuels. About 80% of the global energy output is basically coming from fossil fuels right now. In the Philippines, similar ratio, basically. So you can't just change the system overnight. That's not going to happen. So that's where the just energy transition comes into play, to make sure that as we shift from coal to renewable energy, solar, hydro, wind, of course, the whole nine yards, we have to make sure that no one gets left behind. So how do you make sure, for example, that fossil fuel workers will not lose their jobs and the communities, for example, because here in the there are coal plants, even natural gas power plants, whose owners or operators have established a good relationship with the nearby community. You know, they provide, you know, sari-sari stores, help build schools. So those people will be affected too by extension. So how do you make sure that that particular ecosystem does not suffer from the transition? But of course, at the same time, what about those areas that would be affected by solar power plants, for example? Because you're going to need a big chunk of land to install a solar power plant. But you need, in the Philippines, of course, you also need lands for agriculture. And of course, it's well established how agriculture in this country is one of the poorest sectors. So now you have a trade-off, potential trade-off. Do you go for renewable energy, climate change mitigation, or do you want to go for food security, climate change adaptation? So that's what just energy transition tries to deal with, to make sure that no one gets left behind. That's number one. Number two, loss and damage. So, you know, we've been talking about Ondoy. Of course, this year is the 10th anniversary of Super Typhoon Yolanda as well, which is actually, and Yolanda is very influential in the conversation on loss and damage at the global level. Because if Yolanda didn't happen, many of the current infrastructures in global policy making under UN climate change would not exist. So Yolanda is that influential. But I mentioned that because, again, loss and damage is something that needs to be talked about. Because if you look closely at the 10 most destructive storms in the history of our country, nine of the 10, including Yolanda, including Odette, they all have happened in the last 10 to 12 years alone. Just 10 to 12 years. So if you think about it, for a country that we hear it a bunch of times now, we're in the path of this typhoon belt in the Pacific. We get an average of 20 storms a year. Logically, the more you get hit by a storm, the more you should be prepared. Because you get hit. It's expected. So you should anticipate, you should prepare, and you should try to minimize, if not completely avoid, damages. But that statistic that I mentioned states that that's not the case. The damage is not going down, it's going up overall. So why is that the case? Of course, there's one aspect that, okay, maybe there are gaps still in our disaster risk reduction management, in our adaptation. And that and those are certainly true. Of course, there are people who would say we should establish Department of Disaster Resilience because of that. But I don't know if we have the time to discuss that now. But I can assure you that given the contents of the current bills to establish that particular department, it would not work. It is not ideal for the Philippine setting because it would centralize disaster risk reduction, which by its at its core should be local based. And at the same time, as I was mentioning, yes, there are gaps in the disaster risk reduction management. But at the same time, climate change is getting worse. It's getting more extreme. So our capacity is not keeping up with how fast the climate is changing, how extreme it is getting. And by it, I mean the storms, the droughts. By me reminder, there will be an El Nino, already an El Nino right now. And it's about to get worse. So that's what loss and damage is at its core. That's how I would define it. It's basically risks and impacts that are beyond the current capacities for adaptation and mitigation. What it means basically is it's too much for our country to handle. So it's a combination of both. So if I have to mention just three particular environmental issues, I would mention, of course, overarching climate change, but more specifically, just energy transition and loss and damage.
You know, definitely. Thank you for that. I think you hit the heart of a lot of environmental issues. I do want, we can go, maybe let's start with the first one on climate change. And definitely the Philippines has felt the impact of the changes in the weather, definitely. After having two consecutive typhoons in the past week with Egay and Falcon. And it's amazing. You know, we definitely feel the quote-unquote evidence. But as you are probably are aware, all over the world, especially in social media, it's actually a very divisive issue. There are a lot of people who actually deny the existence of, you know, of climate change. And I was wondering if maybe you can tell us, maybe situated in the Philippine context, is there a similar divide in that debate, or are we all in agreement that since we have been feeling all of this, you know, changes in the in climate, that it's a thing? Like, can you give us a the situation on that kind of debate and in the quote unquote the reality of climate change?
What I can tell you, Matt, is that number one, based on many studies, the Philippines overall knows that climate change is a thing.
Okay.
There's not a lot of, it's not as strong of a denial here as it may be, for example, the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I can assure you.
All right.
But in terms of understanding the specifics,
mm-hmm. okay,
like for example, and the basics as well, like for example, mm-hmm. I'd like to cite this particular study by Meta and the Yale Program on Climate Change Communication. It's available online. You can, you guys can Google it later if you want to.
Uh-huh.
Just type Meta Yale Program. What do Filipinos think about climate change? There's a study out there.
Okay.
The numbers that I saw here shocked me because this survey is focused on social media users. So, which means most likely they are also more, they are expected to be more educated. That's what I'm trying to say. And the numbers, for example, here are the results of that particular study. 51% of survey Filipinos are well informed on the climate crisis.
Okay.
Just 51%. Like, they awareness is different from being well informed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's another thing. It's been well established for decades that the climate crisis is human caused.
Mm.
And yet, only 32% of Filipinos believe that.
32% believe that it's human. It's caused by humans. 32,
just 32%. Uh-huh. The rest believe that, well, actually, there are three options there. Mm. But the number, because the one, the second option is completely natural, mm-hmm. and the third is mixed, both. So they're about even. But it's been well established for decades. So there clearly is a gap when it comes to education and awareness. And just to mention a couple more numbers, only 32% receive climate news at least once a month.
Mm.
The rest, less than once a month, which is bothersome to think about, considering storms happen in our country more often than not, and you can consider them as climate news as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just from my personal observation as well, because I have been also observing how major news stations in the Philippines report climate change, and mm-hmm. I've been able to observe, for example, GMA Integrated News's special reports mm-hmm. on climate change impacts, and I'd say that they're doing a pretty good job
mm-hmm.
when it comes to those kinds of reporting, which of course we should expect from GMA. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is only 32% receive climate news at least once a month. That is not good enough. And just to mention two more, 79% believe renewable energy should be developed.
That's a good number,
But here's the catch. Uh-huh. 54% of the same surveyed Filipinos believe that fossil fuel use should be expanded.
Hmm.
Again,
hmm.
when you think it makes no, it doesn't make any sense because those numbers seem contradictory.
Yeah.
But when you think of how the last two administrations, the current one and the present one, the current one and the previous one,
right?
If you think about their policy direction,
mm-hmm.
that those numbers actually make sense because mm-hmm. the government in the Philippines is promoting a technology neutral or technology agnostic approach to developing our energy resource. It means they don't, as it doesn't, for them, it's about the costs.
Mm.
Least cost is their approach. What is affordable, what is readily available for the Philippines to develop.
Mm-hmm.
So that explains why, at least that partially explains why for so long our country has been so dependent on coal, for example. But coal is heavily imported. So if there's a crisis like COVID or the Russian-Ukraine war, we are basically at the mercy of the global market. And coal becomes very expensive. And therefore, partially because of that, our electricity becomes also expensive. And now, the current administration proposes that we should change from coal to gas because it's cleaner than coal, right? But when you also think about number one, gas is also a fossil fuel. So when it comes to our efforts to reduce our pollution, it doesn't add up. And secondly, like coal, because Malampaya is running out, gas has to be at least imported in the short term as well. So you will have the exact same problems that we have in coal, except it's less pollution, sure, ideally speaking, but it's still fossil fuel, so it still doesn't quite add up. So for me, Matt, that's a big problem. These numbers clearly show, sure, we believe that climate change is real, and that's good. We are aware of environmental issues like plastic pollution and those other things. That's also good. But we're not that well informed yet. And that's the gap that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, that's a lot to think about, actually. In fact, these kinds of, like, the sources of energy is actually spilling into a lot of issues like the economy, you know, and, you know, gas and importing gas and how much we are reliant on, like, the war in Russia and Ukraine. So it's definitely spilling into a lot of the central issues that are more on the mainstream issues, you know, today. Maybe before we can go into the to the more policy issues, I don't know. I'm curious, maybe this is my personal view here. And while, of course, I'm quite aware of the situation. I'm quite aware of the discussions on the climate change. But there, I'm sure I'm not alone in this, is that while I do believe that climate change is humanly, human caused, I'm a little bit skeptical on whether or not we can solve it right now. And I think there might be a segment of certain surveys there. What do you think? Do you think that while the problem is caused by humans, can the solution be caused by humans as well? You know, I mean, I think that's a big question, but what do you think about that? Can we actually solve this climate crisis, which seems massive, you know, and generations of neglect and mistakes and consumption?
Firstly, Matt, I am glad that you are skeptical that human beings can solve the climate crisis. You know why? Because it means you're not ignorant. It means you are aware of what's at stake. You are aware of the gravity of the situation. And that's the kind of commitment and understanding that is necessary to solve this crisis in the first place. That the odds seem overwhelming and it's okay to be scared. Not too scared, of course, to cause inaction.
Right.
But it's important that we all recognize that fact. Because without that kind of awareness, that kind of understanding, the kind of emotion, I don't think people will really mobilize themselves or be willing to be mobilized to take action, even in their own capacities. But when it comes to, well, the bottom line is, well, we're still breathing. So, yes, we can, of course. Like, of course, it's understandable to be pessimistic because actually, I'm kind of the same thing, to be honest with you. And then, you're going to wonder if a climate advocate like myself is pessimistic that this can actually work, what the hell am I still doing in this podcast?
That is a
what
good question.
What am I still doing in my life?
Yeah.
Simple. I remember my origin story. I remember what's at stake. And the way I see it is this. You're right. It has to be human cost. Because if we just wait for the world to fix the climate problem, we're going to be dead. That's not a doomsday thing, by the way. Because even if humanity, for example, ceases to exist because of the climate crisis in the next 100, 200 years or so, the Earth is still going to be here. It's going to be still revolving around the sun, rotating on its axis. The moon's still going to be around unless an asteroid shows up or something like that. The Earth is going to heal itself. We've seen that. that without destructive human practices, the earth heals itself eventually. The balance is restored somehow. It may not be the same normal as before, but a new equilibrium is established. So this is not about saving the planet, because the planet is going to be here regardless of whether we fix this problem or not. The question,
good point. Yeah.
The point is, what we're trying to do is not to save the earth, but to save our world as we know it, and for what it can still be. And as long as we're still breathing,
right,
we can still do that. It may not be successful ultimately, because expectations, but the alternative is not, the alternative is to not try. And then what happens if we don't try? Then the same thing's gonna happen. They might as well try it. And there's still time. And the science says we still have time, but we need to get our heads in the game.
Wow, that's definitely inspirational right there. I mean, I think the most important thing, if I can rephrase what you said, is like, maybe it's not to save like the planet, but to save ourselves from our own, how you say, dangerous and toxic practices, I guess. So let's move on to the next one. So what do you think about the current public discourse on environmental issues? And you've already said that a lot of us are, you know, aware, but we don't get enough regular news. So I don't know. Maybe you can talk about like what exactly do we need in order to improve this kind of public discourse? First of all, are enough people talking about it? Because I mean, maybe I can be corrected on this, but it's not necessarily always on my news, you know, environmental issues or climate change, or even if it does, it doesn't, like, maybe because if I'm so skeptical, I just usually put it on the side. But
well, let me first address what you just said about climate news not exactly being that popular. It's perfectly understandable too, because as much as I hate to admit it, it's just human nature to avoid doomsday news. I mean, we can't really deny that. Even I, as an environmental journalist, I can't deny that. And that's why I said earlier that it's really hard to popularize environmental news when it's at its very core, it brings you bad news. And given the state of the world and the state of this country and the state of probably the communities, many of the communities in the country, people want something lighthearted, something that they can feel hopeful for. So that's why, even though I hate those showbiz news that makes me want to push my fingers into my ears, I don't have to hear them anymore. Unfortunately, it's facts, and we have to deal with that. The best we can do, of course, is, for example, as a communicator, we have to make this climate news more palatable. So that's our challenge, and that's on us. So we have to do a better job at that. But speaking of public discourse, that's where the government can also come into play. Because, again, many people in this country, of course, actually, the majority of the people in this country, if you're going to base it on the election results, are not supporters of this administration. A majority, actually, are not supporters. So, but we can't deny that the Philippine government still holds a lot of credence. That's even the right word. Sorry, a lot of it has a lot of credibility in terms of it has the resources, it has the network, it has the reach to disseminate information to millions of Filipinos. There's still that trust factor that at least a large portion of this country has. Maybe not to all of the government, but maybe to their local government, to the provincial government, to their SK, to even just one department. But the bottom line is, the government has that role.
Right.
And as climate advocates like myself, we want to work with them to ensure that at least what we see, hopefully we share the same vision of what climate action and environmental action as well should be. So when it comes to public discourse, I would say, and this may be an unpopular opinion if some of my other fellow climate advocates are listening as well, because believe it or not, climate advocates or environment advocates, we don't all have the same characteristics. So I guess you can consider me as more one of the more moderate ones. That's even a thing. But Believe it or not, the current administration is actually much better than the previous one when it comes to
Really?
public discourse on climate. Yes, because let me tell you a story, man. In the at least during the second half of the previous leadership, and it was a dark time for
Okay.
more than one. What I can just tell you is that there was zero inclusivity in climate decision making. Zero. Like we hear, we even have some news, or we of course we hear some chitter chatter with our I guess you can call friends within certain government agencies, and the top officials do not want to engage with not with civil society people. And that's actually a part of an official document that was released. I'm not going to mention who it is, of course, against the sensitive part,
All right.
but it can be that disheartening and discouraging, especially, for example, for myself, because at the time I'm still younger, sort of. And of course, you want, as a younger climate advocate, I want to work with the government, of course, because I also want to gain experience. I want to help out, that kind of passion is there. And then to see your government outrightly rejecting any kind of notion of inclusive climate policy or decision making is discouraging, honestly. And it just creates that divide that should not be there, because they're the ones, again, this from the previous administration, they're the ones who's also saying whole of society approach, whole of nation approach. Then make it an actual thing, but they do not, because politics and you know how it is. And that's why believe whether I know it's a bit shocking to hear that, but this current government, at least in since it started, it's only been like a year. It's only been a year in a year plus, but it's actually been much better in terms of inclusive decision making. Of course, there's still politics that's involved, so of course
Like what
not everyone's gonna have the
progress
same.
that they make, in compared to the last one, besides being inclusive, of course. Did they
For
have
me,
any proper achievements? Yeah.
inclusivity will be the biggest progress so far, just because it's such a stark contrast to the previous leadership. And I think it's not just about the president, it's also about the people he appoints. So they bring that kind of different culture and that kind of different disposition as well that really helps that particular case. And for me, I'm just going to say this as well, because now I'm going to sound like I'm defending the government here. But for me, it's hard to compare an administration that's been only in power for a year
Of
plus
course.
to admit to the previous administration that had 6 years. That like there haven't really been a lot of achievements yet, per se. If you're talking about milestones in climate environmental work, it's going to take a couple more. I guess you can ask me that question again probably in another year or two, and then we'll probably have a more answer, because of course there also have some problems that need to be fixed from the previous administration, and there are a lot that are fixed. So if you're looking for progress, like a milestone, I don't think there is one notable positive outcome yet. Hopefully there will be in the next year or two, and I'm really hoping for the best, because well, we'll all be affected anyway.
Now, okay, while we're on the topic, if you had the ear of the president or any government official, relevant to the environment, what do you tell them?
Never really thought about that, because I just talked to some of them earlier today, to be honest with you. Because
Oh, are you
there
not
was this National Adaptation Plan multi-stakeholder consultation.
to say? Wow,
So who
okay.
I literally spoke to them earlier this morning. But I would but basically what I would tell them generally is probably the same thing I've been saying for the last 5 years. And it's very simple. Just make it there's always room for improvement. Like, and of course, well, that's number one. And number two, you say whole of society, whole of nation, then make it whole of society, make it whole nation, whole of nation, make it inclusive. Like, just whatever you promised, whatever you said, make it happen. And that we as civil society will, believe it or not, we are actually here to help out. But of course, not just be completely blindly loyal or anything like that. Of course, about accountability, monitoring, constructive criticism, because that's actually good. That's not bad. People assume that's, hey, we complain all the time. Come on, man. I mean, it's not just in politics. It also applies to pretty much every aspect of life. You have to be, you can't just be completely say yes and all positive and all rosy all the time. You have to be able to have an objective assessment as well of whether or not they're doing their jobs. And stop. And of course, it's not, of course, also uniform across the entire government. Some are doing good, some not as much progress. But that's just life in general. But we need better, and we deserve better, because we're talking about climate and environment here. It's not something you can politic your way out of. So that's those are probably the three things I'm gonna say. Just to recap. First one again is definitely genuinely whole of society, make it genuinely whole of nation. We as civil society are still here to help out. Just just reach out. We're here to help. Like, that's it.
Oh, definitely. Perhaps they have like a specific like wish, like policy wish list that needs to be done like right away from a government, you know, because that's definitely a more general approach. But you have something a bit more specific, more specific policy wish list for the Marcos administration.
Actually, as a network, Action Klima Network, we actually released a statement in time for the 2023 State of the Nation address. And I believe we had 13 specific policy points.
Maybe just a taste. We, or we can
That we wanted
show
to
the link.
Yeah, no, it's basically some of the things I said earlier. Like, two of those are in this as well. Like, for example, just energy transition. Again, it makes no sense to me and to my fellow civil society folks, and of course other non-civil society folks as well,
right?
Communities, faith-based groups, even some local governments actually, that promoting renewable energy, gas and nuclear power at the same time, it's not gonna work, and it's not climate friendly, and it's not consistent. Because, for example, as I mentioned, I already discussed earlier about how gas is basically coal 2.0 in terms of its impacts, not just on our climate mitigation strategies, but also on our electricity prices. And I attended this ADB forum a couple of days ago. And a certain government official also said there about the bottom line of what the energy sector in the Philippines should be. They said sustainable, they said clean, safe, secure, sufficient. But they did not say affordable. They said reasonably priced, which is completely different. So they're still a bit off for me in terms of that particular prioritization. So for us, it's very clear. It should be renewable energy centric. Again, we're not asking for 100% RE immediately. Even we know that's not possible. Just a just transition. There's a target and timeline for when gas plants, for example, should be phased down or phased out, when coal should be phased out, and they should be already being phased out, because even that's what the global experts are saying, the IPCC, that's what they're saying. And should be renewable energy centric, definitely not nuclear, because we can talk about a whole lot of other issues there too. Another thing that we mentioned in our statement is regarding the upcoming, again, the El Nino that already started last month. And Matt, to think of the possibility that during the El Nino season, which I believe usually peaks in the last quarter of the year, to think that a particular area in the Philippines can be really dry one day, and then the next day it's hit by a super typhoon, that's a possibility. Doomsday. That's a possibility. It's logical. So that kind of extreme scenario is very real, and that terrifies me. And we have seen it's unfortunate that many Filipinos have to experience climate change themselves to really start caring about this. Like, if you remember what happened in the school in Laguna a couple of months ago, where 120 students fainted and were hospitalized because of the extreme heat.
Where is this?
Laguna.
Laguna. 120 yeah. students.
It was during an earthquake and fire drill.
Oh.
Because of the extreme heat, they had to be hospitalized. And then suddenly climate change becomes, oh, we have to concern ourselves with this now. Like, I guess you can consider it a silver lining that, okay, at least they're aware now. But no, that's the thing we're trying to prevent from happening. We don't need to experience climate change for us to care about climate change. So for us, in terms of another concern or specific policy call, we should really have anticipatory measures to minimize loss and damage from the potential typhoons and strong El Nino that could actually realistically happen at the same time later this year. And last but and just one more, for I guess we can call about specific bills, because of course we can always strengthen our legal framework in the country. We would also we're also pushing for the passage of a certain law, and we call it the Climate Accountability Bill, CLIMA, to be short. It basically tries to establish a national loss and damage funding facility. Because at the global level, from the last year's negotiations, it took nearly 30 years. But finally, there countries all around the world agreed to establish a global loss and damage funding facility, meaning countries like the Philippines, which frequently gets hit by typhoons, vulnerable to climate change, all that, we can finally get, I guess they do not want to use the word compensation or reparation, because that would automatically mean blame or accountability. But whatever you want to call it, we are going to get compensated. So the developed countries call it whatever they want. It's just, for us, it's basically the same thing when you think about it. But the point is, in the Philippines, because we also want to show that we're not just a country of reactors. We can be a country of change makers, initiators. So this Climate Accountability Bill not only establishes a national loss and damage funding facility, which could be sourced, for example, from taxes and penalties for, you know, the biggest polluters, because, you know, they cost it. Polluters pay principle is a thing. But also, this particular bill would integrate the UN, the United Nations guiding principles on business and human rights, meaning businesses would really be held accountable for their practices. And if they're really helping address environmental and climate issues and not harming environmental human rights.
Right.
So for me, those would be probably the three that I can mention.
Definitely very important and very, very necessary changes. Now, from the government, you know, let's move on to maybe before we wrap this up, you mentioned whole society approach. Maybe start to feel optimistic. I want to ask you, what are some of the positive developments in maybe civil society or maybe among ordinary Filipinos? Like first you've talked about talking to government officials, but how is it like on the other end? You know, like what's been going on there? What are some of the things to be hopeful for there? Positive developments in environmental activism or, fighting climate change has happened here in the Philippines, or maybe even like environmental technologies that you think are positive developments in the grassroots level.
Many of these activities, they do not really get reported often.
Right.
Because
you're first. Yeah.
In the Philippines about crime, you know, there's a report about crime and corruption and, you know, showbiz or whatever concert it is by that singer. I don't even know her name. But there are a lot of good initiatives in the Philippines when it comes to climate and environmental action, especially on the grassroots level. They just don't get reported because, you know, that's our culture here. But rest assured that there are practices there. And these are the particular projects that the government can really support in terms of scaling up and getting funding from. Like I can mention, for example, a particular climate school for farmers in Tarlac, for example. Like that is one of the beneficiaries projects under the People's Survival Fund. And of course, I'll just, for the knowledge of all the listeners. People's Survival Fund, established under Republic Act 10174, which is actually an amendment to our climate change law. It's basically a fund specially designed to provide support and funding to the most vulnerable, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth class municipalities in the Philippines in their adaptation plans. So one of the beneficiary projects is that particular climate field school for farmers to teach them climate smart adaptation techniques and resilience building practices in agriculture, which is very important, especially with the incoming El Nino and potential typhoons in our country. So that's one example I can mention to you in terms of innovation.
Great.
Another one is we are also in civil society, at least from our end, we are also focusing on engaging with financial institutions because, well, we keep talking about science has already spoken that fossil fuels should be phased down, if not completely phased out. But they still get a lot of funding. Like, if you look at the numbers, fossil fuel funding still is still more than climate-related funding. And that should not be the case anymore. So what we, as civil society in the Philippines, is we're focusing on promoting divestment, fossil fuel divestment. We're engaging with banks, corporations, even faith-based institutions. Because some of these groups are shareholders,
right?
And they have significant influences in the boardroom, for example, in banks and other and corporations. So by engaging with them, because they have the inside track, while we can focus on the outside track. So we're trying to hold these people accountable, because when they say we're gonna reduce our coal exposure by 2032. But that only applies to direct financing, but they're still underwriting finance that support coal plants, then you're not really doing your thing. You're not doing what you said you would do. You're just basically greenwashing. And of course, that doesn't mean that they're not implementing sustainable practices. We appreciate that they're also supporting some SDG-related projects, for example. But again, it's about accountability. It's about honoring your what you're saying in public, because we're stakeholders in the climate crisis.
Right,
all of us are. So if you're not if you're just deceiving us because you know just want to make you want to protect your assets, your practices that give you profits at the public's expense, including your shareholders too. By the way, if you're not transparent enough and you're not really clear on these particular transactions, for example, then it becomes a societal issue.
Right.
And that's why we should. So for us, I guess that's two of the things that I can mention to you that some of the civil society groups in the Philippines are doing, which are relatively innovations, but they just don't get reported quite often.
Okay. So then we move from the government to civil society. What about maybe... you can tell us maybe of your experience as to communicating with average ordinary Filipinos and maybe what it's like and maybe the role of average ordinary Filipinos in combating, you know, or alleviating the environmental issues we're experiencing. And maybe this is your chance to address the listeners, you know, what can they do to contribute to this to combating these issues?
You know, I have been delivering climate change talks and lectures and workshops for the past 7 years now. And I, as part of the climate reality training that we did back in 2016, we were keeping track of what we do and we want to report it. Of course, I'm no longer associated with that because, of course, that's my current work is, of course, different now. But I've continued that practice on my own when it comes to keeping track of what I do. So also I can self-evaluate of whether or not am I beginning to slack off, or how can I improve myself, whether as a lecturer or a writer or a campaigner or a lobbyist or a scientist or even a researcher still.
Right.
You always need to have that kind of self-evaluation. The reason why I'm saying this is because I have delivered probably over 150 talks by this point.
Wow.
Tens of thousands of people online and in person.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been to pretty much every scenario you can think of in terms of communicating climate change to different kinds of audiences. You
Right.
mentioned TED Talks earlier. I've also talked to schools, universities. Of course, every chance I get, I'll always, and if I'm free, of course, I'll always accommodate Ateneo. Also, my way of giving back, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I've also given talks to government agencies, even public health conferences for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
But like any environment you can think of, I probably have done it already. So what I can tell you from my experiences is that, like I mentioned, the interest in climate change is high.
Mm-hmm.
People are interested because they are aware, whether in the cities or the provinces, they are aware. They've heard about it. Again, as I mentioned earlier, awareness is different from understanding. And that's what we're trying to do when we give these lectures. We try to make it relatable. We try to make it, we try to talk about them through the perspective that are more interesting to people. Like, it can't just be purely scientific. You gotta try to make it relate to them at some point. You gotta use examples like food, chocolate, coffee, for example. You could do that. You can describe the science of climate change through household items, kitchen utensils. We've actually done that. And so they actually proved to be effective. And one thing that we always emphasize, and we always get asked, again, like you just said, what can you do? I always emphasize three things in particular. Number one, the little things matter as much as the big solutions. Of course, I understand that, you know, big solutions should be implemented. I mean, like renewable energy development, of course you should implement that. But there are 100 million plus people in this country. There are 8 billion people in the world now. That's scary to think about.
Yeah.
But you can't even get half of, if you can even get just half of those people to do the little things, that's a big contribution. And by the way, when we say little things, I always say, what did our parents tell us to do when we're growing up? Before you leave the house, unplug your devices, turn off the lights, turn off the faucets. Like, these are things that we're being told since we were old enough to understand them, right? Even in schools, we're basically being reminded that to the point of almost annoying, but understandable. We understand them now. But now that in the context of the climate crisis, and by extension, other environmental issues as well, these little things matter even more because this is your direct contribution.
Right.
And you might think it doesn't matter, right? But again, if enough people do it, companies and governments will take notice because that would affect demand. That would affect consumption patterns.
Right.
And by extension, that would affect production patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So it all adds up. So I always tell communities that we visit, never assume that what you're doing is meaningless. Every word and action counts. You just have to believe that they really do, because
Gosh.
They do.
Yeah.
So that's one. The second one is that it's not enough. The second one is the second one is about nature. I always tell communities that I visit, how has humanity survived for centuries? We always take notes from nature. How did we build solar panels, for example? We learn from photosynthesis. How did we build airplanes? Of course, we look at birds. The morphology of birds, specifically. So the thing that we can observe, especially after storms, is that the most resilient of ecosystems in nature, the ones that remain still standing, are usually the ones with the highest diversity. What does that mean? It means diversity is key to resilience. I mentioned that because there is no such thing as a perfect solution. We talk about renewable energy for the last couple of minutes in this podcast. Even there's no question that renewable energy is necessary. It's not an option. It's a necessity to solve the climate crisis. But there's no such thing as a perfect solution. Even renewable energy has disadvantages. I already mentioned a solar panel example earlier. You need large amounts of land, but we need lands for agriculture. So you got to understand the trade-offs. So what I'm trying to say is, we should not focus on just implementing one big solution. We can implement a multitude of solutions at the same time and make sure that they are synergistic, that we can minimize, they can cover each other's disadvantages so that we highlight the pros and minimize the cons overall. And that goes back to my first point about the little things. Because that's a lot of solutions, a lot of actions being done at the same time, and they could really make a difference. And that's a thing. Like, there's a study called Project Drawdown that tried to quantify the contribution of even the little things in terms of how much greenhouse gas emissions they're going to save. The number was 37%, which is big. And that's if they're properly implemented. And it's not rocket science to turn off the lights or turn off the faucet. We can all do it. Even education, we can all do it. This podcast can technically count as an educational aspect.
Yeah.
Exactly. What I'm saying is we should learn from nature.
Right.
And number three, in every little thing we do, two things, passion and compassion. Especially for us advocates. A lot of advocates are passionate. I mean, that's why we're advocates. Passionate. But there are dark sides to being passionate. It can burn you out because, you know, fire, passion, but it can burn you out.
Yeah.
Or it might make you lose sight of what you're trying to do. Because especially when you're presenting your policy arguments or debating with other representatives, for example, in workshops, and I've seen this happen more than once.
Yeah.
Some of those UN negotiations, oh boy, they can get really, really feisty real fast.
Yeah.
Even the non-negotiations, even just the workshops that lead up to the negotiations, six months away, it gets feisty.
Right.
So never lose sight. For me, that's the thing about passion. And for me, this may sound controversial.
Right.
But I think this is an important lesson that young climate advocates should learn. That I was never really that idealistic to begin with. And I know that's commonly associated with youth climate activism. You're idealistic, that we want change, chanting, rallying in the streets. Like, I've done all those too. But personally, I don't think throwing paint in very important paintings is going to make a difference. That's just disrespectful. See, that's passion. But that's misguided passion. That's very disrespectful. And as much as I respect what Greta Thunberg's doing, personally, I do not agree with her approach either. At least not completely. Because I don't think going all contrarian is going to work either. And that's where the compassion part comes in. Not the compassion to your political opponents or anything like that. I'm not saying, or I'm not even saying, maybe compassion is not the right word to use for that particular context. But what I'm trying to say is build bridges, not walls. That's not just a political commentary to whatever goes on in North America. That's also very important in the context of, and that's why I don't agree completely with Greta's approach. Because you can't go contrarian all the time. You got to work with people at some point.
Yeah.
Because whether we like it or not, we have to work with what we have now. And what do we have now? If we have an idea of who can influence, can fund, who has the technological know-how, who has the scientific expertise, who can communicate well, you work with them. You don't have to agree with literally everything they do, but you got to find some common ground, because at some point, because that's the best way you can do this, because the climate crisis is a global threat. Local impact, sure, but still a global threat. You got to deal with it. and you got to work with people.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing we can do is within our capacities to work with people. And I'm not saying compassion in the sense that we should ignore what people we disagree with are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if they say something we don't like, let's just dismiss them.
Mm-hmm.
Like we can do that, and that's acceptable. But what I'm trying to say is, it's not enough to just be passionate. You have to be compassionate towards those that have the least responsibility but bear mm-hmm. the brunt of the consequences.
Mm-hmm.
You don't pursue climate advocacy work for glory or money. Mm-hmm. Because honestly, from my own experience, there's not a lot of those in this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never really been about that either, at least for me. You do this because you really want to make, if not the world, your community
mm-hmm.
safer
mm-hmm.
from the era of the climate emergency. So for me, it's those three things that I always tell people. And again, the interest is always there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of empowering them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always those three things. Passion and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Nature. And then that other thing I mentioned earlier. It's yeah. always those things.
Okay. Wonderful. Great. Thank you, John, for that wonderful, inspiring message. Actually, I definitely prefer you to Greta Thunberg, which not only do you share passion, but at the very least, you're both, well, you are definitely more measured, but also very much informed with the science and the, at least the issues. And of course, thank you for sharing your experiences and your insights for this. Now, before we wrap this episode up, let's move on to our last segment of the show, which is recommendations, where you and I, the host and the guest, will recommend some additional material to help us continue be informed and inspired in this issue and topic that is, you know, environmental politics or environmental issues. So I suppose I maybe, alongside maybe whatever you have, I do want to ask maybe what good movies, as someone who does movies, movie reviews in social media, what are good movies that could watch for that can help us be informed and inspired about climate issues? Because one piece of media that really informed me with regards to climate issues, this is, maybe it's not a movie, there probably should be a movie, you know, Captain Planet, you know, it's a reminder, like, the power is yours, where, you know, five kids, you know, which represents different countries of the world coming together and then saving the planet and precisely giving, at the end of each episode, telling, reminding us tips to, you know, close the water, close our lights, things like that. So is there something that is maybe that is to that extent, you know, in our contemporary world, maybe Captain Planet, or do we need a reboot of Captain Planet? I don't know. But what piece of media do you think can have that kind of effect on people?
You know, it will be very easy for me to just say documentaries.
Okay.
I'll just say, watch An Inconvenient Truth.
Uh-huh.
Watch Chasing Corals.
Mm.
Like, watch those things. Like, yeah, of course you should. I recommend you watch them. I think you're gonna. I think people can learn something from those. But for me, again, as good as, especially Chasing Corals, that's a beautifully shot documentary. Okay. I'm not sure if it's on Netflix, but what I'm gonna do instead is recommend movies that do not necessarily directly talk about climate science or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
but rather showcase a different side of climate change related storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I still believe to this day that Game of Thrones is about climate change.
Oh,
I still
boy.
Believe that.
Okay, yeah.
I know we can go on and on about the season 8 and all that, but
yeah,
my point is, I still think that that particular message about uniting politics aside to face a common enemy,
mm-hmm.
that's very climate change, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I still believe that. Mm-hmm. Like, for me, and that's when I realized that movies to inspire, for example, environmental action, mm-hmm. they don't really have to be environment themed.
Mm.
I think it's more important if people can relate to a particular event or trend, and then they see the parallelism themselves, and then that leaves a mark on their head that, yeah, it is like that climate change. So now the interest is there, and then what can they do about it? And I think that's the focus of Don't Look Up, for example. That's precisely, I think that's why it's made in the first place. That's the point. Like, it doesn't directly say, okay, we got to stop climate change now or we're all going to die. It uses instead the metaphor of, I think they use asteroid or comet,
yeah,
or whatever it is. So, yeah, that works because it indirectly references that. But people will remember the movie and then they can associate that with that, with a particular concept. But if you're looking for really climate-related stories that are more Filipino-inspired, that are grounded in our local context, I would honestly recommend Kun Maupay Man Ipanahon.
I've heard of that. What's the English title?
I don't know.
Wait, is this the one with Daniel Padilla and Charo Santos?
Yes.
Whether the Weather is Fine.
Yeah, that's part of the 2021 Metro Manila Film Festival.
Yes. I think it's an Amazon Prime. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. That's good. Yeah. For those of you who have Amazon Prime, watch it. If you don't have Amazon Prime, buy Amazon Prime to watch it. So, I think that's also another good movie to watch if you want a more climate, really directly related to Philippine context. I find the storytelling there to be quite not mainstream in terms of Philippine context. But I think it's surprisingly effective.
Right.
And you know what? I recommend people should watch it anyway.
Yes.
And of course, I think it has, to me, it has all the necessary components of what I think a climate theme movie should be. Like, it has a mainstream actor that people can actually gravitate to, so it can satisfy the filmmaker's desire, of course, to, you know, make profit out of it. That's a recognizable name. Of course, there's a strong climate-related theme, Yolanda, in a particular case. Yes. Interesting storytelling, which I think the movie has. And of course, strong messages and good acting. Like, for me, it was also good, beautifully shot, although there was a bit of a... I'm a bit of a critic when it comes to the movie, so the CGI is a little bit off, but that's not necessarily important. The important is it's something that very similar to Nadine Lustre in The Leader.
Yeah.
It's something that you don't see her in often.
Yes.
And the movie itself is not that usual in the Philippine cinema context. Maupay Man Ipanahon, When the Weather is Fine, falls in the same category, and I think it's a good movie to watch. So those are the two movies that I would recommend.
Wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Maybe non-movie things, if you have anything to, if you want to read something. You have anything? Yeah.
Here's the thing. Many of the materials that I read online are produced by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Oof. Okay.
So yeah, it's basically the global entity that reviews literally all the peer-reviewed journals, articles, studies on climate change. And then they consolidate it into three major reports and a couple of special reports in between every 5 to 6 years. But that's the thing. Even the summary for policymakers can be very technical.
Okay.
So that's what I would suggest, because there are a lot of good materials online as well. I think it's a matter of taking your time when reading them, especially if you don't have a strong climate science background. Because I would recommend that people read those, because those are as credible, comprehensive, and clear of climate-related data and information as you're going to get. It's just that they shouldn't just panic about, if you're really interested in knowing more about climate change, and you should, I recommend that you take it slow, at least if you're not used to the lingo yet. But once you get used to the lingo, I think it's really going to be more, it's going to be easier to digest. That's for the global context. For the Philippine context, I would recommend Oscar M. Lopez Center's Philippine Climate Change Assessment Reports. Yeah, they're basically the local version of the IPCC reports.
Okay.
And it's produced by our country's top scientists. It's a bit dated because it was produced 2016 to 2018, and I was one of them. So that's why I would recommend that. There is a new cycle of reports that's going to come out starting November this year, I believe, from what Dr. Lasco said to me before. So, but at least in terms of comprehensive information in the Philippine context, I think the PhilCCA would be your best bet. So for global IPCC, for the Philippine context, PhilCCA. And of course, PAGASA also produces reports. I think she made them too.
Wonderful. Thank you, John, for those wonderful recommendations. I do love the weather. The weather is fine as well. I double on that. Second the motion. I do have two recommendations myself. When preparing for this podcast, you know, I read a bit. From my main reading source is, let's see, this one is published by Cambridge University Press. This one is entitled The Science and Politics of Global Climate Change by Andrew Dessler and Edward Parson. It's a guide to the debate. And it's actually, well, it's actually very easy to read. And I specifically like the second chapter, which talks about the intersection between politics and science and, you know, how a lot of the times they tend to clash and have interesting, of course, intersections. It's not just political science, it's science and the politics of climate science. So it's not always that simple to say, let's say, to express scientific views, etc., and how sometimes politics is used to suppress scientific truth, or maybe even can be bent for certain political agendas. So it's a simple, I would say, guidebook on navigating the debate of climate change. And the second one, I suppose this one is, well, it's a documentary, but it's not quite as technical or as, let's see, it's not as, well, let's say, I want to say, I don't want to say boring, but it's definitely interesting because it's one that's about La Union. It was produced by College of St. Benilde. It's called Alon, which means wave. It talks about the pollution in La Union. La Union is, of course, a popular tourist destination for surfing and for the beach, but it is also, especially during tourist season, becoming heavily polluted. And so as a result, you know, it's actually an illustration of a whole society approach. There are actually some, you know, eco-friendly businesses and even surfing schools that participate in trying to clean up the beaches and trying to recycle, you know, plastic, recyclable plastic products in order to reduce the pollution in the in La Union, which again is one of the more beautiful beaches in their country, and might as well keep it beautiful, you know, instead of allowing it to degrade with pollution. So it's definitely, it's all up on YouTube. It's less than an hour long, so it's definitely worth watching, you know, especially when a lot of us here usually go to La Union for a vacation, but we probably don't notice, but it gets really polluted. So whenever we go to some place that is, well, that's a part of nature, I believe there's an old saying, leave nothing but blueprints, take nothing but pictures, something like that. Just make sure not to destroy the environment, you know, when you visit, so things like that. I suppose I'll make one more. As Planet Earth documentaries in Netflix narrated by David Attenborough, who's famous for those Discovery Channel, National Geographic channels. Now he's doing them for Netflix, and he would be narrating the beauty of Planet Earth in that British erudite accent. So I think these, if ever you're too tired to watch even comedies or dramas, sometimes you have to be reminded of how beautiful our Earth is, like how beautiful our plant life are and our animals are, how amazing it is, you know, and all the more we have to protect it. Even if it will outlive us, you know, we have to make sure that, you know, have a relationship with this planet, and we have to make sure that it's, to remind ourselves, it's worth protecting, not just for our own sake, but also for the sake of, you know, although we can't destroy, well, we can't completely destroy the planet would win, you know, it's still worth, you know, protecting and preserving, definitely. Okay, so yeah, that was our episode on environmental politics. So before we leave, John, would you have any, well, do you have anything to promote? And if listeners would want to look at more of your work, where can they find you?
Yeah, so to all the listeners of this podcast, you can follow some of my organizations and the mm-hmm. work that we do on social media. For example, Living Laudato Si Philippines, mm-hmm. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and I guess X through at Laudato Si PH. Mm-hmm. And of course, Action Klima also on social media across the board. We are at Action Klima PH. I'm also promoting my new book. It's on...
You have a book?
Yeah, it's very recently published, only limited release though, because we want to be as environmentally ready.
Okay.
When it comes to paper printing. But we do have an online copy available for those who are interested in reading it. Mm-hmm. It's on loss and damage in the Philippine and global context. So we develop it as a resource material for policymakers, researchers, campaigners, and interested readers. We call it Non-Left Behind, and it was mm-hmm. recently published under Central Books. And mm-hmm. We are open to having it viewed online. So if you are interested in doing that, just please reach out through the social media pages that I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. And of course, I also still write environmental and climate articles for Rappler. Mm-hmm. Likas News, and sometimes also the Manila Times. So watch out for some of my articles there.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you very much, John, for all that you do in the name of the environment. All right, so the PI podcast, it will be on Spotify, Anchor, and YouTube. But if you have any messages, questions, or suggestions for future episodes, you may email us at pipodcastph@gmail.com. But until the next episode, magandang gabi, mga ka-PI.